Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hi, this is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
And you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
We have a very different tennis podcast for you today because we wanted to pull back the curtain, speak to some people involved in the game that we wouldn't normally get to hear from, and find out how the coronavirus and the enforced delay, the forced cancellation of so much of the tennis tour is having an effect on people involved in the game. People that are ranked 200 or 300 in the world, people that are trying to run tennis tournaments, people that are trying to run federations of national tennis countries like the UK. We've been speaking today to the chief executive of the LTA. We've been speaking to the world number 211, Liam Brody, the world number 375 on the women's side, who's been putting together a petition to try to find a way to support players that are struggling financially. We've had responses from the tours. And Catherine Whittaker and myself are here to talk all about it. And Catherine, overnight we've had the first words of the ATP's new chairman, Andrea Gaudenzi, talking to a group of Italian media on a conference call, which Simon Briggs has written up. That's quite interesting. And he's also, Catherine, given some information that he believes to be being talked about at the moment, that the US Open might end up being played indoors.
Yeah, today was a day when Simon didn't wake up to discover he'd been scooped by Mike Dixon. really interesting story from Simon Briggs on a number of levels. I mean, we're going to talk about the responses from that we've had. All of them come in today, actually, haven't they? We've been pressing for word from the various governing bodies for a while, and we've had statements today from all three. And Gaudenzi's comments obviously aren't in official statement form, and they do come with the caveat that we and Simon are English speakers, and the quotes were spoken in Italian. But they're pretty interesting, aren't they?
Yeah. He talks here about working on a four-week clay swing, does Andrea Gaudenzi, after the US Open, which, if that were to happen, then that, for a start, needs the French Open that has already been moved once to move back again.
Yeah,
because there's not room.
He sort of casually says, yeah, I mean, the French Open would have to... He talks about this plan to create a clay swing and talks about Madrid happening the week before the French Open, so the week that currently looks like it would be in between the US and the French Opens, although I was led to believe by press releases this week that the Madrid Open would be happening as planned in May, just as an esports competition. We'll talk about that later. We are not doing daily podcasts during the Madrid esports open.
Okay. Even that Andy Murray's playing, apparently.
Yeah. I mean, obviously I'll watch because my... I'll take any entertainment I can get. But and then Gaudenzi sort of casually says, you know, obviously this would require the French Open to move back a week, as if, like, yeah, the French Open are obviously going to play ball, despite the fact that there's been absolutely no indication thus far that the French Open wants to take a collaborative approach to any of this. But certainly logically, of course, it makes sense for there to be a clay swing and for for a clay court Grand Slam not to just crop up out of nowhere the week after another Grand Slam. Obviously, that makes total sense. It's interesting that what Simon said to us on a podcast, just over a week ago, about the rumblings of a possible US Open at Indian Wells in December. I think he reports in the piece today that it seems as though there is little appetite for that, and the preference of the powers that be would be for the US Open to be staged as currently planned behind closed doors, that behind closed doors is preferable to moved back and in a different time and location, which I find very interesting, that a kind of, we now live in a world where a best case scenario is that a Grand Slam is played behind closed doors.
Yeah. Extraordinary to think about that. We'll hear later on as well in the podcast from Stephen Farrow, who looks after all the events in Britain, including Queen's, as to why they didn't decide to play behind closed doors. Also in Simon's piece, he quotes Andrea Gaudenzi talking about the impact, the importance of the ATP finals in November, I think financially as much as anything, to the ATP. The quote here is, if we can sit tight and have the chance to host the ATP finals, that's good. We'll survive. Would we survive 2 or 3 years? Definitely not. The longer it takes to solve the situation, the worse our condition becomes. So there's a lot at stake here, isn't there? And we're going to hear the financial implications for, as I said, players, for federations, for tournaments, and even the ATP, which is a pretty healthy organisation, you feel, on many levels, has a lot to think about here.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't surprise me to hear how dependent ATP finances are on the tour finals. I was aware how significant an event, well, the most significant event for the ATP as an organisation. I believe the same applies to the WTA for their finals. I was surprised to hear Gaudenzi put it in those, to be as frank about that as he seems to have been in that conference call with Italian journalists. Simon also reports what a relief and a boost it is for the ATP that the ATP Cup got played, because that, I believe, resulted, earned the ATP 10 million. Simon reports that it earned them 10 million, and provided it gets played again at the start of next year, which isn't a given, but it's certainly far away enough that it's reasonable to be optimistic about that being played. That would presumably be another 10 million-ish for them to be able to bank on, which feels pretty massive at the moment. But yeah, certainly the finals. I do get the impression that they, even if there's only been the amount of tennis, what have we had so far? 6-7 weeks of tennis? No, more than that, 8 weeks. I think those finals will happen. The ATP finals will happen, even if we go into it with the top eight that we've got at the moment. Who would that be? Who's eight in the world right now?
We'll have to look that up, because, I mean, you know, that's a very good point. Obviously, Novak Djokovic is just fine because he's managed to already get there. But as things stand, it's Novak Djokovic, Dominic Thiem, Gael Monfils, Rafael Nadal, not bad so far, Andrei Rublev, Christian Garin's there, Alexander Zverev, and Stefanos Tsitsipas. Roger Federer just missing out in ninth. So there's your list so far.
That's the race to London rankings, yeah, rather than
that's the race to London. Dan Evans
I
is
did predict
11th.
That Rublev would make
you did, didn't you?
Yeah. So that would be just fine for me. Unexpected Christian Garin in packing area. Roger Federer would be the first alternate. Can you imagine him going to London as an alternate?
I would love that. That's got to happen. It's almost worth having it just to see that. So he's the hitting partner, which would be yeah. which would be great. Christian Garin's hitting partner. That's what I want to see. So I mean, look, that's the top end of the game, and those guys, as difficult as this is for everybody in these current circumstances, and obviously for many people more than those players who have no financial worries. What about somebody that is ranked outside the world's top 200? Liam Brody is the current world number 211. He has been as high as just outside the top 150. He is a British player who's currently staying at his parents' place. He was supposed to be in Barcelona preparing on clay right now, he told me. So what's he doing instead?
Well, I've been not in the gym. I've been in my made up outside gym for the last 2 weeks. Just trying to get as fit as I can, really. I'm in a bit of a group chat with a few of the other players, with Lloyd Glasspool and Dan Evans and his coach Mark Hilton, one of the other guys, Nathan Rooney, and we're all posting our times and our sessions in there, and it's quite good, actually. It gives us a sense of responsibility to the rest of the group to do the sessions and stuff, you know.
So you're effectively kind of making yourself compete with each other on various exercises to try to keep pushing yourself.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, it's very, as you probably know, it's very tough to push yourself when you're on your own and there's no fallback for quitting, especially when you're doing a lot of hard runs and stuff like that, whereas obviously now I don't feel comfortable stopping because I know I'm going to get absolutely rinsed for it if I do.
So, and what can you do? In I mean, I don't know how big your space is. I mean, tell us what your backyard, your converted backyard, looks like. How big is the space, and what can you do in it?
Yeah, so obviously the LTA sent me the watt bike and a little bit of kit, as they did to quite a few of the players, which is obviously a lifesaver for me. I was worried that I actually spoke to Alex Dimonar yesterday and Lloyd Harris ago, and they're not allowed out the house, and they're just going stir crazy by the sounds that they're doing skipping and ab workouts, but they can't go for a run or anything, so they're obviously worse off than we are. But you know, I've got the watt bike, which is great, but you know, I'm managing to get outside and go for pretty long distance runs. It kind of makes you value it a lot more as well, you know, that freedom of being able to go outside.
Yeah. Does it make you miss tennis?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, that if I take a day or 2 days off tennis and I miss it, like you can't believe. And that's been one of the biggest messages in that group chat with Evo and everyone is how much everybody misses tennis already. You know, everyone's saying they kind of give their left arm to be back on court again, even not even competing, just hitting the ball.
Yeah. Because obviously you can't play at all at the moment. You exactly actually can't play tennis.
Can't play tennis at all. I know some people might be able to, you know, whether they've got a home court or stuff like that, but obviously quite a few of the players over here don't have that option, so you know, we're literally just, you know, I've not picked up a racket for 2.5-3 weeks now, which is probably the longest since I was about 10 years old.
Wow. And I suppose, I mean, I know Brad Gilbert. I mean, he in the States, he hits against a wall every day, and lots of people talk about that. But I mean, you need a wall. You need some space.
You need a wall and a concrete floor to be able to play on. The problem is I don't really have a wall big enough, and also I don't have a concrete floor so that you can get that true bounce. There's literally nothing you can do with the regards to the tennis, which is why I'm kind of put a positive. And just try and come out of this little block fitter than I've ever been, really. That's my plan, to be in as good a physical shape as I can be.
One of the challenges as well, Liam, must be that we don't know how long this is going to last. So that mindset, we actually had Dan Evans on the show, I think, 3 weeks ago when he'd just come back from Indian Wells, and he was saying he'd got plans to get on court, and he was hoping he'd be able to go and train with Mark Hilton, and he was going to go and meet up in Birmingham. But I think Mark was coming down from Nottingham, and obviously that has quickly gone by the wayside. But now we know what he's doing. He's in the group chat with you. You're training, trying to get as fit as you can. But this is 3 weeks in. We've got no tennis until mid-July at the very earliest. So how are you going to sustain this?
To be honest, I'm going to take it a week at a time. you know, I've done two weeks of good training. I'm just focused on this week. I don't even want to think about the future right now, because otherwise I'll probably stop training. So I'm just going to focus on it a week at a time. And obviously each week I get under the belt is another week towards the physical shape. Maybe towards the end of the lockdown, I might take a week off completely just to rest, and then, you know, hit the hopefully 4 to 5 weeks we have of training, if everything's a plan, before tournaments as hard as I can.
What does this mean, Liam, for you financially? Because tennis players don't play tennis. They can't earn prize money. Now, obviously, there are other ways to earn money or to be supported, but what does this mean for you?
I mean, obviously, it's very tough. I mean, you know, I was going to be playing French Open qualifying, which is about, you know, around about 10 grand. I was obviously pulled in qualifying, which is, you know, another 10 grand. And who knows what more above that. I saw that the LTA are bringing out a little support package and stuff. So I guess we'll see what extent that's to. But yeah, I mean, it's just all, you know, I'm almost not even thinking about it until I have all of the information. You know, it's quite worrying though, because I'd like to be able to still continue playing and almost stop on my own terms rather than having to stop because of, you know, the financial side of things. But so fingers crossed, you know, something happens with that.
That you're right, the LTA released details of their package to support players and venues and coaches last week, and we'll hear about more about that in a moment or two, but that's still to come, and it's not something that is necessarily happening elsewhere, so hopefully that will be some help. But just to give listeners an idea, I was looking through your last 3 or 4 years of results and the various prize amounts you would have got for various tournaments, and you know, you've got tournaments where you've reached semi-finals or finals of challenger events, and depending on the level of those events, it can range quite dramatically how much you get. And sometimes you're maybe getting $2,000 or $3,000 for getting to a semi-final or a final, and yet you turn up at Wimbledon last year and you won through two rounds of qualifying. You just missed out on the main draw. I remember you being 2 sets to 1 up, and you lost in 5 sets. But you still took home £22,000. And if you'd have won that match, I think you'd have been getting nearer £40,000 or £50,000, which is just enormous amounts of money. I understand your situation. You've got to make that work for you for the rest of the year. But it's a huge deal, isn't it?
I mean, you know, I was speaking to somebody about this last year, actually, about I'm not even sure if I'd still be playing tennis if, you know, as a British player, we didn't have Wimbledon, because I've become so reliant upon, you know, obviously the guys at the All England gave me the wild card into qualifying last year, and I'd like to think I kind of almost justified it anyway. And I've become so reliant upon that financial package that comes with Wimbledon. I mean, it's I can't imagine what players from other countries, non-slam countries, will have to do to find a way to survive and continue playing this sport.
Do you have to adjust your lifestyle in order to make it work? I mean, have you found at all over the last 3 or 4 years? I mean, you've had some years you've made maybe $60,000. I know your best year you made about 140. You obviously have expenses coming out of that to keep your tennis in good shape as well.
And you also have to remember those prize money checks are before tax. Of course, which is obviously quite a large chunk when you think about it. And then you need to take into account the coaching fees. And then you're obviously paying for your coach's travel as well. You're paying for your own travel. The ATP have actually are moving in a fantastic direction, I think, at the moment. They've just brought back 5 nights of hospitality minimum for the main draw players at the challenger level. I think before it was maybe 3 nights. So obviously, when you're abroad, if you lose first round, you've got to pay for 4 or 5 nights of accommodation. It's all sort of not very cheap, whereas now, you know, minimum 5 nights, it does actually make a big difference. So I do think I'm aware of the players' problems and plights, but you know, it's still a long way to go, I guess.
How often do you think about money when you're at a tournament? I mean, if you were in that position, 2 sets to 1 up at Wimbledon, can you put that out of your mind, knowing that you're talking about £25,000 difference if you win that next set of tennis. Do these thoughts ever come into your head?
Do you know what? They never have. They only ever do off the court. And because I'd play this sport for free. I'd pay to play this sport. I do pay to play this sport. You know, and I'd do it for zero financial gain, which is what I've been doing anyway. So the prize money per round, and I know a lot of people have said to me that, you know, it messes with their head when, you know, you're playing a third set tiebreak for 20 grand or something, but that never crosses my mind in the moment. That, you know, losing a match is worse than losing money for me, and you know, winning a match is the feeling of winning a match is a lot better than the feeling of winning the money. But obviously, you know, in the cold light of day with a logical mindset, you can, you know, completely understand that thought process as well.
Yeah, that's very interesting to hear you talk about how you would pay to play this sport, and you are effectively paying to play this sport. Have you ever sort of felt like you're doing quite well financially? Obviously, you've had really good runs of results. You got just outside the world's top 150. But have you ever felt like, oh, I'm doing all right now?
Maybe when I was younger. Obviously, I was a pretty successful junior, and sponsorships are much more forthcoming at that sort of age. So there are lots more avenues financially. And obviously the federations support younger players more, which, you know, again, all of that's completely understandable because you're almost, you know, paying for potential there. But as you get older, it becomes harder and harder to make a profit. And again, you know, you have to fund your coach's career and life as well at the end of the day. And I don't think I would class myself as a person who hasn't invested in their career financially. I think sometimes I could invest a little bit more, you know, but that's all a learning curve at the end of the day.
You're 26 now. You're a fit lad, as we can hear you. You're trying to get even fitter. I just wonder, given the situation we're in, how are you actually feeling at the moment? Because I mean, it's a pretty lonely life on the tour.
Yeah.
And I just wonder what it's like working away in isolation and knowing that you're not going to be able to play the sport for quite a while yet.
Yeah. One thing I would say, absolutely loving being at home. Again, this is probably the longest I've been home since I was 15 or 16 years old. So it's kind of nice in that sense. And somebody said to me the other day, actually, is it hard for you? I said, do you know what? It's not this. It feels completely normal, which is weird. But the one thing I would say is, like I said before, it's the sport, like, you cannot believe. You almost feel a little bit anxious not playing. I suppose it's made a little bit better knowing that the other guys aren't playing either. But at the end of the day, tennis is my life. And you know, not being able to continue with your life is a pretty rough, weird situation.
Is there a point, Liam, that you or players you know, if this carries on, are going to have to give up the sport and get another job when this is all over? Because, I mean, how sustainable is it?
Yeah, I mean, if not, there are going to have to be some pretty good results when we come out. We're going to have to come out firing. But, you know, not everyone's going to be able to do that because there's only a certain amount of tournaments. So there'll be some players that will just manage to dodge the bullet by, you know, hitting a good run of form. Hopefully, you know, there'll be federations like the LTA that provide, you know, sort of packages and possible loan deals. Hopefully, you know, the one with the LTA is good enough that I'll be able to continue paying and pay them back, and then, you know, be able to get to a stage where I can fund myself again. But like I said, that, you know, the non-slam playing countries, I think a few players that have to stop playing, you know, the ones like me that become reliant upon the slam qualifying prize money, you know, to lose that is a pretty heavy hit.
Yeah, I'm sure. Well, Liam, it's lovely to talk to you and wish you all the best with it. And as you say, one week at a time.
Yeah, thank you, mate. Stay safe.
So there's Liam Brodie, who is trying to keep in shape as best he can and be ready to go as and when that will be, none of us know. And it's a difficult situation for everybody, as he says, easier for British players and Slam Nation players than many others. And he also referenced the support package that the LTA are looking to put in place for British players and for coaches and for venues to keep the game functioning in the near future. So let's hear from Scott Lloyd, the chief executive of the LTA, on the package that's currently being put in place in the UK. Well, Scott, thank you very much for joining us. These are tough times for everybody, certainly more wide-reaching than just sports, but they do include challenges for sporting federations like the LTA. What sort of challenges do you face?
Well, you're quite right, David, that you know, the most important thing to say at this time is that the health and well-being of everybody and our thoughts being with everybody that's been affected by the coronavirus. But you're right in that our sport is far from exempt from its impact. And, you know, this pandemic has the potential to put the continued further growth of tennis at risk. So we know that many, many people involved in tennis in Britain are concerned about their futures and are facing many challenges, which is why we announced an unprecedented support package last week to ensure that clubs and venues can remain viable while coaches and officials also are not lost to the sport during this challenging time. I mean, from a federation's perspective, we're a not-for-profit organisation, so we are committed to investing our net revenues back into tennis and the delivery of our five-year plan. You know, we, like any business, are impacted by the uncertainty around our future revenues and our future incomes. And so we have to take a really good, strong, hard look at our cash flows and how we might be able to support that wide variety of stakeholders, if you like, the community, the tennis community in Britain, over the coming weeks and months.
I suppose, knowing that the LTA's finance comes in part, at least, from the profits of Wimbledon, the news that Wimbledon isn't going to take place is obviously a blow on a number of levels, but it appears that they were ahead of the curve in terms of having some insurance in place that will help to protect your future and your future plans.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, and we're obviously delighted that that's the case. And we the LTA work hand in glove with the All England Club on a number of different committees that oversee matters like that. So that's obviously a fantastic position to be in, given the circumstances. Notwithstanding that, you know, the level of the insurance policy, the level of the claim, and the timing of any payments that go to reimbursing the championships for its costs at this moment in time remain very uncertain. So, you know, we have to continue to focus on the management of our investments and of our costs and make sure that we stay healthy in that financial sense so that we can continue to support tennis more broadly and of course, hopefully in time, get back into investing in its future.
We heard, Scott, from Liam Brody here on the Tennis Podcast, just explaining what it's like to be a player ranked in the 200s. He told us how much he loves the sport, misses it, would play it for nothing, really. But he also pointed out that, you know, obviously there's a financial aspect to trying to keep going as a tennis player. He said how lucky he feels to be from a Grand Slam nation, that he's enabled to play so much better than players maybe that aren't from Grand Slam nations, but the repercussions are far-reaching. You've mentioned the coaches, the officials, venues. Tell us about what you can about the package that you announced on Friday.
Yeah, well, I mean, Liam's a great professional, and you know, being a professional tennis player is a really tough job at the best of times. And obviously, the you know, a lot of the fans and the media focus on those top players, those top 100 players that are playing in the big tournaments week in, week out. But players like Liam that are looking to earn their living and to make their way on the tour, it's an incredibly challenging sport. And so, you know, this period of time where prize money and incomes are, you know, are just simply not there, only make it that much harder. So what we've been looking to try and do is specifically put in place some support grants for British players and the single side that are ranked outside the top 100, right the way through to around 750 in the world. And on the doubles side, up to 250 in the world, who wouldn't normally receive LTA player funding, player grants. But you know, what we're looking to try and do with those players is just put something in place that helps tide them over for the next 3 months or so. We can't, totally replenish, totally replace their normal incomes, but we just want to try and put something in place that helps tide people over. And then furthermore, we're looking to put in place some enhanced tournament bonuses, particularly an increased prize money for particularly for British Tour events, which is the domestic calendar of events that players like Liam and through those ranking ranges play week in, week out whilst they're here in Britain. And if we can do that in the back end of the calendar in the autumn of this year, to give players those chance to recoup some of those earnings that they might otherwise have been playing for, again, that's something that we'd like to try and achieve.
And I suppose playing domestically may well be the first step for the return of tennis, really, because international travel is that much more difficult.
Yes, I mean, right now, this minute, it's difficult to see quite where the international calendar is going to be able to resume because of the point that you've made. So we're starting to scenario plan for a whole range of different eventualities, whether that's a return to international tour for our top elite players and how we can help support and prepare them in readiness for that, or indeed in the absence of the international tour returning throughout the course of this year, how we can step up and have a more comprehensive domestic calendar as and when the circumstances allow here, and as and when we can start to put on events like that. So, you know, that's something that we're looking at, and in some ways we think could be a huge opportunity, for the LTA, but not obviously for the players, but for the LTA in driving some visibility of the sport again and giving our fans, some exciting tennis to watch. We've been looking at really innovative ways to keep people active and for particularly our younger audience, younger fans, to play tennis at home. So I would just encourage anybody to check out our website, lta.org.uk, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter feeds, because we've got some great stuff out there. And I think we're one of the few governing bodies that's really got on the front foot and provided some of our LTA youth content to try and fill those hours whilst we're all at home.
So there's Scott Lloyd, the chief executive of the LTA in Great Britain. I did also send an email to the head of communications from the USTA in the United States to ask their position on whether they're planning to do anything similar. And I heard back from Chris Widmire, who looks after the communications there. He did say that he expects the USTA will be announcing a support program in the near future, which they're looking at right now, and where to redirect and redeploy funding in order to make things work. He says more to follow on that, but the LTA did act pretty quickly here, the quickest really out of any. We haven't heard of any of this stuff from any of the other big federations yet. I suspect Tennis Australia are going to do something as well, and it's, as Scott was saying, I mean, it's designed to sort of tide these players over, and there's a similar kind of plan in place for coaches as well. But there is such an unknown out there. I mean, thank goodness they can do something.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a coup generally, but it's a fantastic PR coup for the LTA. I mean, it's brilliant. It's a fantastic privilege for those involved in tennis in this country that is able to happen. I've of course linked to Wimbledon income being protected by that pandemic insurance. Of course, the LTA gets a surplus from Wimbledon income. It's expressed as a surplus because they're both not-for-profit organisations. But that doesn't mean that the LTA income won't be hit, because, of course, they get a grant from the government. You know, the club revenues are going to be down. You know, they're going to be hit from other sides. I do find it interesting what you were saying that Scott Lloyd was talking about in terms of the impact this is going to have on participation and the presence of tennis in the country. yes, I do see that. But equally, for me, what I've always thought of as one of the biggest challenges for tennis is losing out to other sports. Kids that are good at tennis tend also to be very, very good at other sports. And this is something that I think Tennis Australia has talked about a lot. In a country where most kids play every sport under the sun, they're sort of more attracted to, naturally drawn to team sports, and kids that are really good at tennis up until the age of sort of 13 or so, where you have to make a choice, more often than not choose away from tennis. Well, that's not going to be the case. Not, yes, they might be losing absolute ground, tennis in this country and in every country, but not going to be losing relative ground to other sports, unless you count jumping up and down at the foot of your bed on a yoga mat looking truly ridiculous as a sport, which I am doing at the moment.
I suppose the one difference with tennis, it's depending on how long this takes, is that Britain's great shop window is the next 3 months. And if good conditions returned later in the year, yes, as Scott said, that they will do everything within their power to put tennis back in the spotlight and make opportunities available. But you've missed out on Queens and Wimbledon and that opportunity.
Same goes for cricket. Same goes for golf. Okay, football will be able to, you know, football gets played at all times of the year bar a couple of months in the summer, but cricket, golf, athletics, they're all having entire seasons wiped out, also losing their shop windows. So
yeah.
I'm not saying it's not a blow, it's a devastating blow, but relatively that ground isn't being lost in the way that it might feel. I'm clutching for positives.
I know, I get your point, and I hadn't really considered it in those terms before you mentioned it, but it is a fair point.
You know, kids at school aren't doing anything besides Joe Wicks PE, are they?
And their dads. If I'm anything to go by.
You know, it's not like kids are discovering other sports and going, this is better than tennis, don't want to do tennis. And I think, no, you know, for me, despite my crooked back and various other ailments, I keep thinking, oh my God, all I want to do is be able to play tennis.
Yeah. Well, that was actually quite nice to hear Liam Brody talk in those terms about just how in love with the sport he still is after quite a few years as a pro. I mean, he's 26 years of age now. Just to say as well, the LTA did announce as part of this package, as well as supporting the coaches and officials, they did also announce that they were going to need to furlough some of their staff. Scott Lloyd and the rest of the leadership team there have said that they're all going to take a 20% pay cut. This is going to have an impact on people, and we're going to hear more about that from the ITF a little bit later as well, who've just sent out a statement. But I'd like to hear first, Catherine, from a player who is not from one of the Grand Slam nations. And I think that this is a really important element to this, is that we consider people that just are never going to be able to have that kind of backup. And Sofia Shapotova from Georgia is ranked 375 in the world. She's 31 years of age. She has been playing for many, many years. Obviously now can't play. She's currently staying at her parents' home, and she recently started a petition to try to draw some attention to the plight of players like herself and all of her colleagues, and Catherine asked her about that.
Obviously, our attention was drawn to your situation by your post and the petition that you've started for financial support for lower ranked players from the sports governing bodies. Could you explain that a little, what you're calling for, what prompted you to start that in the first place and feel like you needed to take action?
Well, the first problem with this petition is that I started it because I wanted to know how many players are struggling, because I had conversation obviously with many of my friends, and well, I know that the situation is not great, but I wanted to see how many people struggle and how many agree actually on the petition like this. Basically, it started as a tension because all of the players I know and I communicate with, we all sent some emails to ITF in particular, and we didn't really get a lot of answers on the questions we give. And as this is a very special occasion, I would say, something like this never happens in tennis. I do think it's something that a tennis organization can help us with because tennis players are self-employed. We're not a contractors and we don't have any security. And the problem also is that whilst all the people think that tennis players are millionaires, that's not the case. Only top players on very top are actually gaining a lot of money. And everyone that's lower than top 100 supports themselves from week to week, basically. So once the sport stops, you actually don't have money for the next week. Well, some of us maybe do for a couple of weeks, but obviously most of the tennis players struggle a lot. So I wanted to know if organizations think about us and they have any idea what they're going to do with us, they have any backup plan. Is there, obviously, they also have a lot on their hands and it's not something that you are prepared for, obviously, but aware their players, they also need us like we need them. And it's just a cry for help, attention, and just to know if they're going to do something about us, because it's been already a month that tennis stopped and there have been no news whatsoever about what's going to be with players and what the organizations are going to do about us. And also it's very difficult because Grand Slams got cancelled, like Wimbledon got cancelled first time since World War II, and I would say this is a huge catastrophe in tennis. Nothing worse can happen. And obviously the organizations take care of it, but still, that doesn't change the situation. The players are uncertain. We don't know if anything's going to happen. We'll always get the answer that, well, organizations are considering and everything, but it's been a month, honestly. It's been a month, and I know many people who can't parent this month, and I know many people who already struggle to support, like, normal everyday life. The only situation that helps is you actually don't go out, so you don't spend that much money. You basically need to buy food, but I still think there has to be some news and players have to feel that, well, we are not contractors, we're self-employed. Still, we pay licenses, we pay taxes, we pay fines, we oblige the rules. We try to be good sportsmen and have good morals and we play every week. And I do think that we have to have some information from our organization, whether they care for us or they will do something about us or they at least heard us, you know?
So there's Sofia Shapotova, the world number 375. Catherine, you had a good 20 minutes on the phone with her. What else does she have to say?
She had a whole lot to say. Obviously, you could hear there the internet connection via which we were speaking wasn't the best. So we're not playing too much of the audio, but it's a bit of a shame because she had so much meaty stuff to say. She's in Georgia, which is in lockdown. They're in a state of emergency, that country. All tennis courts are closed, all tennis clubs are closed. Her training, her access to training facilities is pretty much nil. I said what training are you able to do, and she said bit of yoga. So yeah, she started this petition, as she explained there, because she kind of wanted to, first of all, test the temperature, wanted to know how many players are struggling, as she said. Tennis players are self-employed with no security. You know, she described that petition as a cry for help and attention, because it might not sound that long, but to her, the fact that it's been a month, you know, I could hear in her voice and see in her eyes how agonizing that month has been. A month has felt like an incredibly long time. And it's pretty clear that for players ranked pretty much, I mean, it's obviously on a gradient, but outside the top 100, obviously getting more and more acute the situation, the lower down you get, it's a pretty hand-to-mouth world. As she said there, she knows many players that can't play rent, but can't pay rent this month. She will come on to the fact that we've had a statement from the ITF shortly. She said she had sent a couple of emails to the ITF in the last few weeks. She's had replies to those, but they've been kind of holding messages saying that they're considering their options. She talked a lot about the problem specific to tennis being that there's not really a sense of community, not just down to the fact that there's no explicit players' union and no clear singular voice. But she said this is a really competitive sport and the nature of it doesn't lend itself to a sense of community. She said we're not supportive enough of one another as players compared to other sports, which I found really interesting. And I think she is, well, I know she is, she did say as much as she understands everybody's got stuff going on, big stuff going on, you know, their own personal concerns and anxieties. She is disappointed that more high profile people, players with the luxury of a platform, aren't speaking out more, aren't creating more of a voice for tennis as a whole. And that comes back to the feeling of union among players. She said there'd been an email from the WTA to players informing them of the various loan application schemes around the world. And she said she'd consulted with a lawyer about those to see if she was eligible, but the lawyer had informed her that the majority of tennis players aren't eligible for those loans because, of course, they do their earnings, their revenues look quite high on the face of it often. But, of course, a lot of the time their expenses are close to equal to those earnings, right? So profits are... Yeah, exactly, or exceed those earnings. And she also said, which is a really interesting point, that most of those loans require a guarantor of some kind of security, a guarantee against those loans. And tennis players don't have that. They just don't have any kind of security like that. She said, I and most other players ranked outside the world's top 200 coach to supplement their income just to make ends meet. And obviously... coaching isn't an option at all. It's desperate. She was incredibly composed and well spoken and calm, but she seemed sad. You know, it was really striking that this is, I mean, I keep saying it's tough for everyone, but it was tough speaking to her. Luckily she had a lovely little Pomeranian that made an appearance midway through the interview, and it genuinely did make me feel better for her. I thought, oh, at least you've got a dog with you. it was pretty moving, really. She said that she thinks a lot of players won't come back from this. She thinks many will quit. She said even when tennis does restart again, many won't have the capital, the money in the bank, to be able to travel to events to start earning again. They're going to be so much kind of in arrears that they won't be able to deploy the expenditure required to start earning again.
Yeah, that's it is a tough business to make a go of it, really, in the first place. And quite interestingly, over the last 24 hours, we had Patrick Mouratoglou putting out an open letter in which he talked about the challenges faced by players outside the world's top 100 and felt as though it's time tennis did something to help them and urged all the governing bodies to get together to try to sort something out, whilst also saying that he felt that the top 100 players that are making money absolutely 100% deserve the money that they've got, which did lead me to think, well, okay, well, what are you actually suggesting here, Patrick? Because it's all well and good saying that you feel like something should be done, but I don't see any suggestion here as to what that should be. We have invited Patrick on to the podcast to let us know his thoughts. We have been directed to his PR person, so we'll perhaps hear from that person at some point in the future. But we did get a statement in the last couple of hours, actually, from the ITF, which was addressing more the fact that they are having to cut their own cloth accordingly. They're putting half of their staff on furlough as in terms of what they call a job protection scheme, which obviously is designed to reduce their own costs as well. Their senior leadership team has taken a 20% reduction in salary. The ITF president, David Haggerty, has voluntarily taken a 30% decrease. And they've said as well, towards the bottom of that statement, in addition to these measures, the ITF is in discussion with the other tennis stakeholders to look into the various options to support nations and players during these times, and will provide more information when we've completed that process. So that perhaps will eventually address some of the concerns that Sophia has been raising and the difficulties faced out there. We also contacted the WTA, which elicited a statement from the chief executive, Steve Simon, which was quite candid, I thought, and quite interesting. Catherine, you've got that there.
Yeah, I do. He says, for everyone in the tennis community and beyond, this has been an unprecedented, challenging time. Our hearts go out to the fans, the players and the tournaments, including the tournament staff, none of whom are getting what they were counting on. We wish there was a way everyone, especially those in need the most, could be compensated at the level they were expecting. But the needs are so great and the WTA, unfortunately, is not in a financial position to do that. Professional tennis players are independent contractors and not employees of the WTA. As a result, a player's compensation is based on on-court competition, and when tournaments are not held, this puts a pause on their principal revenue flow. The WTA fully recognises the challenges these athletes are facing, as well as those similar challenges being dealt with from millions of people around the world during this unprecedented situation. That being said, the WTA is diligently working with our tournaments to maximise earning possibilities when the professional tennis circuit is able to resume, and is considering an extension to the current 44-week season to enable more tournaments to take place. It is our sincere hope to return to the court as soon as possible. When the health and safety of our players, fans and staff can be guaranteed, we will be back competing.
Yeah, so that shows you how handcuffed they feel they are in terms of being able to make a material difference to players that are as low ranked as players in the 300s. But it sounds as though, frankly, you're all on your own, really. We're going to do our very best to provide an infrastructure for the return to the sport, but we can't exactly sub you in order to just get by.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's clear that everyone involved here is broadly well-intentioned. Nobody wants tennis to go to the wall, or individuals going bankrupt or going without food or paying their rent. I mean, one positive that this has brought out in every one and every aspect of the world is sort of a sense of community and goodwill. And I don't doubt the intentions of all these bodies, but it does worry me slightly that the ITF, in the last aspect of their statement there, have said we'll be speaking to our stakeholders to see what help they're able to offer. And stakeholders, to me, sounds like ATP, WTA and federations. Well, LTA aside, who we know are in quite a privileged position, it sounds like even other Grand Slam nations, if what Simon's reporting in his piece are accurate, are in potentially quite dire straits, let alone players from smaller nations, less wealthy federation nations. And that statement from the WTA, I really appreciate how candid it is about the WTA just not financially being in a position to support their players. So if the ITF is looking to the WTA and the ATP to step in, it sounds like I don't know, it's the sort of logically working through that female players from smaller, less wealthy nations are, which is exactly what Sophia is, are in an extremely precarious situation. And they're the ones most likely to be in a precarious situation to start with. You know, the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. That's what happens in a crisis, right? As Mary Carrillo said a couple of weeks ago. But obviously, if everyone could wave a magic wand and provide financial support for all players, coaches, they'd be doing it.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I'm just going to interrupt this little bit of the podcast here because literally 2 minutes after we finished recording this edition of the show, we saw a tweet by John Wertheim of Sports Illustrated saying that he'd got a note issued by the WTA to the players, which reads thus: "This email has been sent to you on behalf of our Players' Council and board representatives. The WTA has been suspended, as you know, through the first week of July. We realise the financial strain on many of you due to lack of playing opportunities. For that reason, we have arranged for all players who are currently full and associate members of the WTA to receive a rebate of the membership fees you paid for the last 3 years. Full member fees are $1,500 per year and associate member fees are $650 per year. So, for example, if you've been a full member for all 3 years, you'll receive $4,500 and so on." So there has been a little bit of relief given to WTA players as a result of the Players Council and their members fees rebate. Now back to the pod. Should top players be putting a fund together between them, the top 10 players on either tour, in order to support
really,
the lower ranks?
My instinct is to go, yes, absolutely, why wouldn't they? But I'm really, really wary of the sort of clickbaity culture, and we've seen it so much with football and Premier League football, of uproar about millionaire athletes not sticking their hands in their pockets. And actually, there was a very interesting podcast from The Athletic this week, their weekly news podcast, just drilling down into the finances of the Premier League. And there's been a whole load of criticism of Premier League footballers as to why they're not all sticking their hands up to take a 30% pay cut. And kind of the headline of that was what they would be being asked to do there is to subsidise the Premier League, which is an extremely wealthy organisation. It's sort of on the face of it, quite an unreasonable thing. It's the Ornstein and Chapman podcast, if you want to have a listen to it, and it drills down the exact finances pretty clearly, and it did put things into a slightly different perspective for me. And I'm also wary of the fact that we don't know what players are doing. Just because they're not doing it publicly and making a song and dance about it doesn't mean they're not doing stuff. And that's a really fine balance, isn't it? Because it enables those that aren't doing stuff to help to hide behind those that are and aren't wanting to make a song and dance about it. So yes, I'd like to think that they are helping because kind of that's the spirit of this whole situation, isn't it? People sticking their hand up to help, whether it's financially or practically, emotionally, volunteering, whatever it is. But just because we're not hearing about it in a eye-catching, glitzy PR release kind of way, doesn't mean it's not happening. I hope that it's happening.
So what about tennis tournaments? What happens when a tennis tournament has to decide that it can't go ahead? Stephen Farrow is the tournament director of the Fevertree Championships at the Queen's Club. He also looks after all of the events in the UK outside of Wimbledon leading up to it, all those grass court tournaments. And one of the questions that I had for him was, why couldn't tournaments be played behind closed doors?
Our view all along was, my personal view, but actually the view of us more generally at the LTA, and it matched the view of Wimbledon, which was that behind closed doors, we felt wasn't really workable. Because if you look at why you would be playing an event behind closed doors, well, it's because you didn't want to get a large group of people together. And, you know, obviously getting 9,300 people together at Queen's each day is a lot more than, you know, 500, 600, 700 staff that we would need to service an empty arena with no spectators in it. But we would still need about 500, 600, 700 people all together in order to service a behind closed doors event. And so that always felt to us like something that just wasn't realistic. I think added into that as well, I mean, I really doubted what the appetite of players would be to come and play in any event when the government has dictated to us, or the sport has dictated to us, that no fans can be allowed in, but we're still expecting them to travel, to undertake international travel, to come and play in front of nobody. You know, it never felt to me like something which I personally thought was particularly realistic for the sport. So my answer to your question is, it was seriously considered, but it was never something that we thought was realistically going to happen.
What happens when you have to cancel an event? When this all suddenly was decided, what do you do next?
Well, the decision from a tour perspective, I mean, for all our ATP, WTA and the ITF events we do, because of course we do the lower level ITF Pro Series events, the ITF Women's event that we have in Manchester that's a part of the grass court season. So for all the ATP, WTA and ITF events, ultimately it is the decision of the tour to cancel the event. You know, we had a very open, very good conversations with all three governing bodies. And, you know, I would say that one thing that I think struck us here was quite how open and collaborative and pragmatic that all the governing bodies were about, you know, how realistic it was to go ahead, and also the impact on tournaments. You know, we got together as a group of grass court tournaments, you know, both us and the tournaments taking place in mainland Europe during that period. And, you know, we very much formed a collective view that it wasn't realistic for us to carry on any further. And then it was for us, we then went to the ATP, WTA and ITF and said, this is what we think the situation is. We initially were looking at the end of April to make a decision about the feasibility of the grass court season, but we ended up bringing that forward because I think what we all found, both in the UK and the, you know, the guys in Germany and Holland and Spain as well, is that because so many events were falling by the wayside, we are all the events, even the ones abroad, they've got an element of temporary infrastructure to support them. And what we all found was, you know, our contractors were beginning to shut down, and, you know, there were various things around the edges making it more and more difficult to think that we were going to be able to deliver the event. I mean, one really good example, I mean, down in Eastbourne, where, you know, the top car park at Eastbourne, which is where we build the broadcast compound, is going to be used as a temporary food depot. You know, a lot of the hotels in Eastbourne were shutting down. You know, we heard from other hotels that they might be used for the NHS. Little things for us, which seem sort of relatively small, but are really important. How are we going to train ball crews when the schools are closed? It felt like every day during the first couple of weeks of March or up to the third week of March, something else happened, which made you think, I'm really not sure whether we're going to be able to go ahead with these events or not. And we all collectively, both in the UK and in Europe, we were at the same point. If anything, the tournaments in Europe because they were subject to more severe restrictions at that point and were further ahead with us in terms of the what's happening with the virus in those countries. If anything, they were pushing more for an earlier decision than we were. But we certainly had a very collective view that it wasn't sustainable. We went to the tours, the respective tours took that decision. And then obviously for us, for all the grass court tournaments, a big part of it was where Wimbledon were as well, because all of us are here in order to have great events in our own right, but also to provide the best preparation for Wimbledon and very supportive of everything that the championships offers. And so we were in close contact with Wimbledon, all of us as grass court events, in terms of what they were thinking and where they thought they were going to go. And then ultimately we were in the position on the 1st of April to make an announcement at the same day that the whole of the grass court season was going to be cancelled.
And there are so many knock-on effects, aren't there? There are so many people. You mentioned contractors. I mean, these are people that helped to create the tournament, from building the stands to all the jobs that are around a tennis tournament. It's a huge operation, isn't it? I imagine you had a lot of phone calls.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, it's still going on now, dealing with the repercussions of it. I mean, we work with some fantastic contractors who we've worked with for years and years and years. We have a great group who are really take a lot of responsibility for delivering the events. I mean, up and down the country. I mean, not just Queens, but, you know, look at Queens. We've got the likes of Arena. We've got Neptunus. You know, we're Absolute Taster, our caterers. These are all fantastic companies who put so much into our event, working all year round, really, to deliver the temporary infrastructure and create that experience at Queens that we love so much. And same at all our events, similarly at Eastbourne and Birmingham and Nottingham and elsewhere. There's a lot that goes into the events, and there's a lot of people who put a lot of love and care, and it's a real highlight of the year for so many people. So, you know, we're conscious of that, you know, both sort of the fact that it's a big disappointment to many people. It's obviously financially challenging for a lot of people right now in the broader economy, as well as for our contractors. And we just have to be hopeful that we all emerge through this period stronger, or at least we survive, so we can then build up over the years to come. But it is certainly a challenging period. And but, you know, at the same time, what I would also say is, I mean, to go back to the point I said about the ATP, WTA and ITF, I think with regard to our contractors and everyone who plays a part in our event, there's a real sense of people coming together to support each other. So, you know, we've had some very open, honest conversations with a lot of our contractors. We're very much trying to work together through these issues. And you know, I'd even extend that out to, you know, a lot of the players as well. You know, it's been really quite touching. So there's the messages that I personally have had, and some of the other tournament directors in the UK that we've had from players, like saying how sad they are that the grass court season isn't going ahead. Is there anything they can do to help? You know, and that's quite special as well, because it shows that what we do every year really means something to people. And it shows that hopefully we'll be able to emerge from this in a strong position, because we've got that great base of support that will mean that we'll be able to grow again in the future.
Yeah, you mentioned to me the other day, I mean, obviously we work together at Queens, and obviously I know about the messages that you've had from the players there. But the one that really struck me was that you got a note from Donna Vekic, who maybe you don't know so well, but she just got in touch.
Yeah, and I thought that was amazing. I mean, look, there's obviously the players that you and I know very well, David, from the years working at Queens, and the likes of Marin Cilic and Grigor Dimitrov and Milos Raonic and you know, a lot of these guys who, and Feliciano Lopez as well, you know, all these guys who we know very well, who come back year after year. Jamie Murray as well has been great. But yeah, Donna, who I don't know so well, just emailed me out of the blue and said she was really sad to hear about what happened with the grass court season. Was there anything that she could do to support? So, you know, we're doing a bit with Donna on our social media. And, you know, I thought that was really nice. It shows how much they value what we're doing. And also how important it is to them, the grass court season. I mean, the idea of Queens not happening, of Eastbourne not happening, but I mean, obviously Wimbledon not happening. And I have to say that, I'm a tennis fan, I obviously work in tennis, but I obviously love the sport as well. I mean, you get so engrossed in it. And we were dealing with, you know, flying by the seat of our pants a bit in terms of, you know, keeping all the plates spinning, about, you know, trying to keep things going during that difficult period leading up to cancellation. But, you know, the minute that we were cancelled, like the next day, I think we were all slightly in shock, because when you take a step back and you think, you know, Wimbledon's not going to happen for the first time since the Second World War, you know, similarly with a lot of our other events, you know, these are events that have happened for decades and suddenly they're not happening. I mean, that's it's a heck of a June and July are going to be very, very different without them. But, you know, there's a huge sense of perspective given by what's going on right now. And there are so many people suffering. There are so many people struggling financially, struggling with the virus. You know, we're in the privileged position that we are healthy, and all we've got to worry about is dealing with the repercussions of cancelling tennis events and looking ahead to 2021. So we're thankful for that. And the decisions that were taken to cancel the events were obviously the right ones in the context in which the whole country and the whole world and the situation we're all facing right now.
Just finally, in terms of those repercussions and planning, how far reaching are they, or is it just too early to know at this stage?
I think it is a little too early to know exactly what the consequences of what's happening now will be for our 2021 events. We at the LTA obviously run loads of events all the way through the year. You know, it's not just about the summer grass court events. We've got our ITF women's event in Shrewsbury, which was also cancelled a few weeks before the grass court events, which was that's a fantastic tournament there, which is really growing. And Dave Coulteen, the Shrewsbury club there, who runs that event for us, does a fantastic job. And it's a real shame to see that fall as well. We have the Murray Trophy in September, the ATP Challenger event we do, and we have a number of pro series events and other events all the way through the year. So, you know, I think in the immediate challenge for us is what's going to happen to the events that we've already got in the calendar later in the year. And for that, like everyone, we're just, you know, waiting to see what happens. You know, when will the tour will be able to restart, when regional, international, domestic tennis will be able to restart. So there are the repercussions from what's happening now that we're looking at for the rest of the year. And obviously you get to November time, ATP finals taking place in London, Davis Cup finals scheduled to take place in Madrid. You know, what's going to happen to those events? We hope very much that they'll go ahead. But, you know, obviously nobody knows really at this stage when restrictions are going to be lifted and what situation we'll be in. So there's that element of consideration. Also for us, again, it's quite hypothetical, but depending what happens in terms of when restrictions might be lifted, how will we at the LTA be able to respond to deliver events to give our players both from the lower ranked professional players to the highest ranked professional players we have in the UK? What can we do to be able to support them getting some sort of competitive action in order to return to return to the tour in the best possible condition, as well as start getting people engaging with tennis again later in the year?
So, Catherine, it shows just how much is up in the air, doesn't it? How everybody really is just trying to work this out on the fly, including us. It's a pretty impossible situation.
Yeah, no, I mean, all got to hold our hands up and say none of us were remotely prepared for this as individuals, as apart from Wimbledon, as individuals, as organisations. It's completely blindsided all of us, and we're scrabbling. Some organisations are panicking, some less so, but we're all scrabbling. And that's completely understandable. But I was listening to a podcast today. I've been listening to a lot of podcasts, you'll be not too surprised to hear, with Alain de Botton, the philosopher. It's the How to Fail podcast. And I mean, there's just so much beautiful wisdom in there. I'd highly recommend it for anyone struggling with the situation, which presumably is everyone. But he said it's a sign of sanity to experience some insanity in scenarios like this. If you're dealing and coping with all of this brilliantly, you're not normal. I mean, I wish I were you. You're not normal in a brilliant way, and good luck to you. But nobody's coping with this brilliantly. Everybody needs to be cut a bit of slack. I know that's easy for me to say from a relatively privileged position. I wouldn't expect someone like Sophia to be quite as easily able to say something like that. And I think that's understandable too. But just because there are people in a worse situation from you doesn't mean that your strife and your despair is invalid. It is, and it's tough for everyone, individuals, organisations, governing bodies, millionaires, paupers, everyone. Mm. We weren't expecting this, and it's crap.
Except, Catherine, the tennis podcast is kind of prepared because we've got Tennis Relived, thankfully, to look forward to, which is going to be coming your way over the next few months. We've got another one of those on Monte Carlo final weekend, as should have been, in which we're going to talk about a couple of, well, a classic match from Monte Carlo final weekend and a great Fed Cup memory as well, because that would have been Fed Cup finals week, wouldn't it? So we wanted to mark both of those. So that'll come up in a week and a half's time from now. On Monday, we've got another show for you. We've got the listener question special that we recorded pre-end of the world.
In a different world, yep.
Yeah. I really must listen back to that before I put it out so that... So that I have the first clue what on earth life used to be like back then. Also wanted to send our very best wishes to our year-long tennis podcast mascot, Butler, and his owners, who are such wonderful people. And we've heard from them that Butler isn't very well. And we are thinking of Butler, aren't we? Because he's the best dog. I say that about all of our mascot dogs and all of the dogs that get sent Catherine's way, and they are dozens of them. But Butler is an absolute beauty. We're thinking of you.
All dogs are the best dogs, but Butler really is great.
Butler's and, a bit special.
I've been thinking about Butler over the last few days, and... Yeah, we wish you well.
Mm. So, Catherine, thank you. Go and have a beer. I'm going to go and have a beer. And then we will be back with another tennis podcast on Monday. We hope you've enjoyed this one. Bit of a different one, but hopefully it's given you an understanding of a little bit more of where we are in the tennis world right now. It's a funny old place to be, but we'll take it a day at a time. See you on Monday.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.